Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How well do Dallas and Fort Worth take care of their homeless residents? After years of declines in the number of men, women, and children trying to survive on the streets, some advocates are worried about rising numbers of people who may be at risk for homelessness due to the recession. Joining us today to talk about what actually works to help the homeless and about work that remains to be done, we have Otis Thornton, who is homelessness coordinator for the City of Fort Worth, and Mike Faenza, president and CEO of the Metro Dallas Homeless Alliance. Welcome, both of you, to Think.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be back.
It has been a really cold winter so far this year. Is that affecting the demand for shelter beds?
In Dallas, all of our shelter beds are full, and we believe that we have a relatively small number of people that are not sheltered at this point. What the response to that right now is the city's of Dallas's crisis team is out on the streets in the evening bringing people into a newly created space at the bridge and some other facilities, but we're running right at capacity, and so the demand is really high, probably higher than it's ever been.
And in Fort Worth, what we're finding is our Presbyterian Night Shelter is our largest emergency shelter for the homeless, and capacity is full at that shelter for men. What we have had, we still have some space available for women in the Presbyterian Night Shelter, and there's space available at the Salvation Army in their emergency shelter as well. So while we have seen an increase in the demand for overnight beds as the weather has gotten colder, we have not been full. We have we feel that we have capacity to meet all of the demand that's out there.
We should point out the fact that being homeless doesn't necessarily mean that you're trying to survive on the streets. There are also people who don't have permanent housing that are staying with friends or family members.
Correct, correct. And in a time like this, a lot of people end up seeking housing with families, with friends, that is very temporary for them, yes.
What puts people at risk for becoming homeless? And that seems like such an obvious question, but some people might have more resources in a crisis than others.
Absolutely, and it really does boil down to resources. What puts somebody at risk of homelessness primarily is poverty. The absence of a place to live is 9 times out of 10 a consequence of a shortage of or lack of access to affordable housing.
You know, Metro Dallas Homeless Alliance does a homeless census, a point-in-time count each year in January, and we'll have that in the next couple weeks. But what we see consistently in surveys of several thousand people is the number one reason that they state they're homeless is loss of a job. So I think during this time with the high unemployment figures, a lot of people who have lost jobs, people who have lost their mortgages, were at risk as a considerable increase of people that don't have stable housing and are in temporary settings.
And then is it harder to get a job again once you're homeless and you can't give an address to a prospective employer?
Absolutely. Not only not having an address, but not having identification. Your job search is compounded by not having access to public transportation or reliable personal transportation. Jobs available in the Alliance Corridor in North Fort Worth, for example, are difficult for homeless people, some low-wage workers who live in the central city, to access those jobs because of a lack of public transportation.
I think it's important early on to say, just broadly speaking, maybe two types of homelessness. And one is the individual individual adult who we say is chronically homeless, who is, and that is a person who has had quite a pattern of being on the street in a shelter. We see that for the most part, that person has a mental illness, substance abuse challenge, and or a physical disability, and that is probably the most visible homeless population and the people that are really at the highest risk. But the majority of the real personal and community tragedy of homelessness is is invisible, really, and that's acted out in homeless shelters and programs for children and families that are homeless, and a lot of that homelessness is caused by the situation of joblessness, lack of affordable housing.
And then what does it take to help? Let's talk about the situation of families who may be temporarily homeless. Beyond simply shelter and food and medical care, what do they need to really get back to a place where they can care for themselves independently?
It's a great question, and I think you named three of the big ones. You've got to have shelter. You've got to have access to decent, affordable health care. And employment would be the one that I would add to the list. Employment is always going to be a way that able-bodied Texans get back to work, get back into housing, and are able to retain the housing once they get there.
You know, and well taken, Otis. I also think child care is a huge issue, probably throughout North Central Texas, but certainly in Dallas. Metro Dallas Homeless Alliance is in the midst of a planning process looking at the needs and the gaps in services to homeless children and families. And the lack of affordable child care is a huge need. We have a couple of very strong programs in Dallas. One is Vogel Alcove that serves over 100 children each day, but the gap between the need for child care for poor families, working poor families, and homeless moms and kids is really huge. That's something we really need to work on.
That's a great point, Mike. The United States Conference of Mayors recently released a report, I believe it was on Christmas Eve, indicating that most cities, a majority, 16 out of 26, I think was the survey set, were experiencing something that we've seen across the nation, which is while the overall number of homeless people has stabilized or gone down just slightly, the increase, the uptick that we've seen as the economy has swung downward has been in families with children. And rapid rehousing programs that quickly assess and help families get rehoused as quickly as possible, provide them with the supportive services that they need to retain their independence and their housing, connect them with those services, like Mike mentioned, healthcare, housing, shelter, and child care. Critical.
Let's talk about different kinds of supportive housing, because my understanding is that there are several different avenues that people can go down, but there are certain landowners who are not altogether interested in renting to people who have previously been homeless.
That's true. One of the major challenges in developing housing for formerly homeless people, especially people who've been chronically homeless and may have a mental illness or be recovering from substance abuse, is what we really see is a myth and a misunderstanding on part of many people in communities that a supported housing project in a neighborhood will have a negative impact on the values of property and the quality of life. And I have to say that in all my years of experience, I've never seen a permanent supported housing program developed where there was neighborhood concern or opposition after the project was in place. The fact is that formerly homeless people can make great neighbors if they have the supports they need in the housing. Yeah.
We actually took a study. We wanted to examine that very question, and we did a study in Fort Worth where we examined the impact of permanent supportive housing on the property values of neighborhood parcels. And what we found, curiously, was that parcels that were closest to permanent supportive housing developments actually appreciated faster than the neighborhood at large and the city in general. Now, we don't think that's causal. We think that would be a spurious argument to make. But we do believe that you can say permanent supportive housing clearly does not decrease or devalue someone's property or stagnate the growth in their property.
I want to talk for a minute about this idea of, you mentioned earlier, Mike, that there are two kinds of homeless people. Those who are chronically homeless are viewed by some people as being sort of as choosing to be homeless.
Right.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, there are so many myths around homelessness, and that's understandable. One really direct experience we've had in Dallas that really shed some light on that idea that chronically homeless people don't want help, want to be homeless, is the experience of the Bridge. It's Dallas's Homeless Assistance Center, and the city of Dallas and philanthropists have put a lot of resources in developing this facility at 1818 Corsicana, south of downtown, that now serves about 1,000 people a day. The demand for health care, mental health care, job coaching and job searches and rehabilitation services there is just huge. We have people that are waiting in long lines to get appointments, who've been out on the street for a good number of years, who've fallen through the cracks, who put a lot of energy into getting help. I think that there are people out there that have learned how to live on their own and outside of what we would think is a sustainable living quarters, but that want to be there. I would say 99.9% of those people, if they were offered an apartment in a reasonable deal, they would take it. And a lot of the reasons that people don't get help is because the kind of help they need is not available to them.
What are the barriers to people who are either mentally ill or struggling with substance abuse to getting the care that they need?
Access is point one, I would say. The availability of services at a centralized location like the Bridge makes it easier for folks who are in that location to access services. I think there's always been a challenge in our healthcare system of effectively combining behavioral health care, substance abuse treatment, mental health treatment with primary care. And yet clinicians find that that's an incredibly important part of delivering effective care when you can combine those two treatment modalities. So I would say that access is a first barrier to folks who are struggling with mental health and substance abuse addiction.
And one of the things you do in Fort Worth is actually send paramedics out on a regular basis to try and identify needs among the homeless population?
We've got a program with it's actually with the UNT College of Osteopathic Medicine, and there are student doctors who do clinics on a regular basis. We're also just this week have launched a new outreach program, not dissimilar to the outreach program they have in Dallas that's funded through the city of Dallas. We are looking towards the development of a central resource facility in collaboration with John Peter Smith Hospital. At its centerpiece will be a clinic that will provide behavioral health care, primary care, and dentistry in a one-stop location.
Otis Thornton is here. He is homelessness coordinator for the city of Fort Worth. Also, Mike Faenza, who's president and CEO of the Metro Dallas Homeless Alliance. You can join the conversation now by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about homelessness in North Texas. Support for KERA comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Facing the mortgage crisis is part of CPB's Public Service Media Economic Response Initiative. My guests this hour are Mike Faenza, who is president and CEO of the Metro Dallas Homeless Alliance, and Otis Thornton, homeless coordinator for the city of Fort Worth. If you want to be part of the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372. I'm curious about what hopes each of you holds out for whatever kind of healthcare overhaul we may or may not end up with, and what's on the table right now with regard to people who are homeless.
Yeah, I'd say first and foremost, it's going to be tricky regardless of what the plan ends up looking like, but it's access for people who are low income or really in the depths of poverty to get preventive health care. And, you know, it's the plans are so complex and the policy issues are fast moving and I don't think totally understood by any of us. But if we can come up with a plan that'll make it a lot easier for people to avoid waiting 8 or 10 hours in an emergency room for their health care, especially for children, that'll have a large impact on a lot of the problems that we face in communities for people who are vulnerable.
What do you think, Otis?
I guess I would expand on that and say prescriptions, assistance with prescriptions has got to be a part of a successful health insurance reform. I believe that access to care will have to continue to expand. We've just gotten to a situation that it's unsustainable for poor people generally and homeless people in particular.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Robert in Plano. Hi, Robert.
Hi. Thank you for doing the show and, sure. And appreciate the guests' work. A couple of years ago, my wife was briefly on Medicaid when she was pregnant with our son, and we were grateful for the service, but it really struck me as odd that the Medicaid people would schedule her during the day and tell her to show up between 8 and 5 p.m., and if she couldn't make it because, say, she was working, they would just tell her, well, you know, then you can't receive any services. And I'm curious what you think about that, how Medicaid appeared to really prohibit her from even trying to work and earning a living while receiving those services. And it seemed to perpetuate that cycle of poverty and of not being able to work. And I wanted to hear what you think about that.
Thanks for your call.
You know, I think that there locally that how Medicaid is delivered through our public entities, public contracted providers has changed some. But the absurdity of the situation your wife was in is it's not uncommon. And this whole issue of delivering health care and social services to people with needs, especially those unlike your wife that chronically need those services, are really difficult. And probably the biggest single principle in terms of making health and human services really workable, that it's integrated and it's and people are looked at as whole people, and that health care and human services are integrated from the top. And that's not been the case with Medicaid.
There's also an economic dimension to the delivery of healthcare services to the homeless that I think has really been a pivotal piece in the conversation about homelessness in Tarrant County that has helped us to galvanize support around the issue. One of the things that we're doing is we are focusing our housing efforts on folks who are classified as medically vulnerable. Now, this came out of some research that was conducted by a physician in Boston named Dr. Jim O'Connell. And Dr. O'Connell studied death records of homeless people. And what he found was that there was a cluster of 7 to 10 characteristics that put somebody at a heightened risk of imminent death. And what we did was we have used that data. An organization called Common Ground operationalized it as a survey We've surveyed 1,145 people as of the end of the year to see if they had any of these characteristics that placed them, put them as medically vulnerable. And what we found was that 46% of the folks of those 1,145 actually were considered medically vulnerable. The thing that's stunning about that is that in the previous year, every one of those people had been to the hospital, had been admitted to the hospital 1.2 times. Mm. Now, that's just the public hospital system. And further, there had been 1,325 emergency room visits in 90 days from those folks. So a stunning number of publicly funded, medically vulnerable services being delivered to folks who are medically vulnerable.
Yeah, let's talk for a minute about, you know, we've talked about the risks of becoming homeless and we've talked about some medical issues that can arise. Talk about some of the other risks to people's safety. How vulnerable are people who are trying to live on the streets to crime?
They're very vulnerable. And I think, you know, one of the myths about homelessness and actually people with mental illness that it is a big factor in chronic homelessness is that people are violent and dangerous. And there's really, in terms of victimization, it's the homeless person that most often gets victimized. And that's one of the just a huge practical issue in developing programs so people are out on the streets so they're not vulnerable to be victimized. And the situation is especially tragic, I believe, with women. We need to create public policy and funding where there are no women, you know, out on the streets. It's rare to find a woman who has been homeless for any length of time and has had to live on the streets that has not been a victim of sexual violence. And so the rates of trauma and the need for services for women who have been homeless in the area of mental health and treatment for trauma is huge, and we need to create services so we can avoid that. One of the thoughts I have in you know, the discussion we're having today and some of your, you know, questions have, you know, pointed out some of what I think Otis and I really believe are myths around homelessness is that homelessness is here to stay. We're always going to have homeless people. We just need to accept that. I think that because homelessness has been for a few decades almost an intractable problem in every major American city, you know, American psyche is set up to think that. I totally disagree with that. I just, you know, a few minutes ago at the break noticed, you know, Otis on his BlackBerry and we have the technology, you know, to do amazing things. The technology is there to solve homelessness. To prevent homelessness and certainly to provide the kind of treatment and recovery programs that homeless people do. It's just a matter of political will, and guys like Otis and myself doing a lot better job in venues like this and others in educating, you know, the American public that this is a problem that can be solved. We do not have to accept the least among us sleeping on the streets or in warehouses or having kids in emergency shelters. That does not have to happen. And the solution is affordable housing and medical care and most importantly, for people who are really vulnerable across, you know, ages and population, it's housing that has support services attached to help them recover from homelessness and be successful and part of the community. We absolutely know how to do that. And I know that in Fort Worth, and I know a lot more in Dallas, we have examples of huge successes in making that happen. We just, as my boss says, who's the czar, homeless czar appointed by Mayor Leppert in Dallas, Mike Rawlings, it's halftime. In Dallas, we have had a 60% decrease in the numbers of people sleeping on the streets in the last 5 years, and it's that decrease has corresponded with the development of permanent supported housing. There are solutions.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Raul on Highway 67. Hi, Raul.
Good afternoon. I have heard in several places that about half of the homeless are military veterans. Can you confirm that or clarify that? And if so, give any reason why. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
We cannot confirm that. It is sad but true that anywhere from 20 to 25% of the homeless population at the national level is estimated to have served our country in the armed services. However, locally, we find that those numbers are lower. In Fort Worth, we're running about 14%, 13.8 of homeless are veterans. There's some legislation currently in the Senate related to a no-tolerance policy for homeless veterans. One of the confusing parts for many people is that veterans benefits underwent a great shrinkage a number of years back, and the eligibility for receiving full veterans benefits, it's far more difficult to be to receive the full range of VA benefits than it once was. So it's a difficult population to serve. I do believe that the VA and the Department of Defense have done a good job with Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom vets who are returning trying to provide some enhanced services at disenrollment to make sure that folks with concerns are shunted towards the services that they need.
Mike talked earlier about political will, and that's something that we perhaps still need to get to. Is it ultimately financially less expensive to provide the kind of supported housing that you've both talked about than it is to care for people who are in health crisis situations or in certain situations to incarcerate people who might be homeless?
Well, it definitely is less costly, and I think that there really is very few policymakers that would disagree with that. The problem is that it takes an investment up front. And even if you can save several million dollars in a local jail by creating permanent supported housing, there's costs that are fixed. And, what is most on the minds of understandably elected officials is what the budget looks like right now. So to make the investments we need to make, they need to be made through planning that is long term, that goes beyond the terms of any elected official or any administration. And I think we're just nationally and certainly in Texas beginning to look at the solutions to homelessness as something that needs a few years of investments and incremental gains. And
the Susan Cockrell, the director of special programs at the Fort Worth Housing Authority, pulled some numbers, got a consent to release medical records from one of the tenants that they had housed under a homeless program. It's a 53-year-old woman who had been homeless for 15 years. In 6.5 years, she had accrued over $63,000 at the John Peter Smith Hospital. It's our public hospital. They had moved her into an apartment. And in the 13 months since she had moved into the apartment, we had spent $473 at JPS on the same person. Now, that doesn't include the amount of money that it cost the MedStar ambulance to get her there, the amount that we spend on gasoline to get four firefighters there as first responders, the amount the community spent to feed her at the Salvation Army, a place for her to wash her clothes at the Day Resource Center for the Homeless. All of those costs added up, clearly very, very expensive. The cost for the program that provides her robust supportive services that have helped her progress continuously over the last 13 months in her sobriety and the housing, $11,250. So clearly, I think the cost-benefit analysis is there. doesn't begin to touch the opportunity costs that we're losing out on in investment in neighborhoods from businesses, neighbors, and tourists.
Great example, yeah.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We speak next to Larry in Fort Worth. Hi, Larry.
Hello. So I have a question about another segment of the homeless population. I'm a muppie who had an experience with homelessness in my 20s just through a series of unfortunate events. And, you know, every time I see homeless people, I think, wow, that could be me if I hadn't been lucky. What about those people, the people who basically are able to maintain themselves but have just had a run of bad luck? How do we service those folks and make sure they don't get into the cycle? And I can take my answer offline.
Thanks for your call.
Well, you know, there's a lot of homelessness that can be prevented by programs. And one of the just an example of something that's very large and timely was a federal investment through economic stimulus money in a program called Homeless Prevention and Rapid Rehousing. And what is happening in Dallas, and I certainly believe Fort Worth also, is that federal money that's come through the state and to this to the city is being used to identify people that are having problems paying their mortgage payment, utilities, and helping those people financially so they can maintain their housing and keep their and stay stable. Otis also mentioned the concept of rapid rehousing earlier in the dialogue, and some of those some of that economic stimulus money is also being used to identify people who have just recently lost their homes and quickly get them apartments and get them started with utilities and rent money to prevent that you know, a trajectory of homelessness over time. So there are ways to prevent homelessness, and very proud that our the administration in Washington had created that program, Homeless Prevention Rapid Rehousing.
Mike Fanza is president and CEO of the Metro Dallas Homeless Alliance. Otis Thornton is with us as well this hour. He is homelessness coordinator for the city of Fort Worth. We'll resume the conversation in a moment. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Otis Thornton, who is homelessness coordinator for the city of Fort Worth, and Mike Fanza, president and CEO of the Metro Dallas Homeless Alliance. For more information, you can go to the blog at kera.org/economy and find information about where you can find help. If you would like to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We'll go next on the phones here to Fort Worth and speak with Nancy. Hi, Nancy.
Good afternoon, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask both of your guests if, in addition to tax-based social programs, if cities have experimented with foster-type programs where local families could assist with the temporary housing of families in need. And the reason I asked that question is I first became interested in it after Hurricane Katrina, when there was a lot of outreach of local families taking in people. And my husband and I, who have resources to do something like that, have often wondered if there were similar opportunities within cities for homeless population.
Thanks for your call.
How many would you like to take? No, I seriously, the majority of the adoption programs that that I'm aware of are not sponsored by local government. They tend to be initiatives of private, faith-based, and community-based organizations. The mayor of Denver, John Hickenlooper. They have a very progressive, very successful homelessness eradication program. They challenged the faith community in Denver to take responsibility for helping to mentor 1,000 households, some number like this. Now, the effort there was really focused on developing relationships that were mentor relationships, not actually housing people in their homes. I'm not aware of an effort that has encouraged folks to adopt it. Might be something we could think about.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of potential working with the faith community to really directly tie into individual families, and not made a lot of progress on that yet.
Family Pathfinders in Tarrant County is an organization that has been working with a faith-based homeless coalition to try and think about how can we better involve volunteers in doing just that, providing a mentor type of relationship for folks once they get off the streets and out of the shelters. One of the reasons that people will cite, one of the hesitations that people have of leaving the shelter is a concern about, well, what will happen to me if I get sick? How will I know where the grocery store is? How will I get connected with new friends? Because the community that they've developed, quite frankly, are other homeless people living on the streets. So one of the things that we're interested in are these mentorship-type relationships where people can develop a friendship with somebody that they can provide support and lend advice and counsel in key times. We're not looking for drill sergeants, and we're not looking for sugar daddies. We need people who can help with job leads, provide practical advice, help them get connected with the resources that they need above and beyond the social services that are provided by the army of organizations that are out there working with the programs that are publicly funded.
You know, it's so interesting because you mentioned this mentoring, and you spoke earlier, Mike, about treating the whole person. It seems like for those of us who don't work with people who are experiencing homelessness, it's really easy to almost in the way that a doctor is accused of sort of treating a patient like their condition, to not recognize the fact that these are human beings with feelings who want to have friends and who want to have communities. It's really easy to sort of summarize them as the sum of their needs.
You're right. And one of the largest obstacles to serving homeless people effectively is those of us who are not homeless, our attitudes and our reactions to people. It's the issue of respect and being able to feel on a equal par as a person who is helping you is huge in this enterprise of helping people who are homeless. And at the Bridge, I think with all the success we've had in that large campus of services, still the biggest challenge is creating a culture where staff and volunteers and homeless people, you know, despite the structure that's needed to have order, treat each other with respect and as equals and with tolerance and patience. And it's very, I think it's very easy for most of us to be condescending to people that don't have the opportunities we do. It's part of human nature. So when you're interacting with homeless people on the street or elsewhere, keeping in mind that that person really has a need for dignity, has had a lot on them, and actually relating to that person as an equal, because you really are, is key.
I want to talk for a minute about resources of donor labor and of money, yeah, and things like that. It has become, it's a very kind gesture, but it's almost a cliche that people want to volunteer at a soup kitchen or volunteer at a homeless shelter at Christmas when people are hungry and homeless 365 days of the year. Is there a sort of drop-off that is something you have to plan for every year in support after the holidays are over?
Yeah, I think that's a challenge, is keeping that kind of commitment and concern you know, that we have during the holidays going the whole year. And I have to say, and I would guess that it's Otis's experience too, that in Dallas, there are just a huge number of people out there of all ages and all walks of life that want to help in this area of homelessness. And the volunteer response to homelessness through churches, through civic organizations, has really been terrific. And if it wasn't for that volunteerism, the philanthropy that was there, we would really be hard strapped to make the progress we're making in terms of homeless services.
Yeah, first and foremost, let's say thank you.
Really?
The impulse, the desire to serve, to help, to volunteer is all good. One of the things that we've been thinking a good bit about in Fort Worth recently is how to encourage people to best align their energies and enthusiasm with efforts that really help. For example, people will show up sometimes in the East Lancaster corridor and begin to serve food out of the back of their car or off the back of a pickup truck. And unfortunately, the good intention of that activity sometimes leads to unintended consequences that they don't see after they drive off. Concerns about food hygiene are obviously always prevalent. It's also the case that our shelters prepare a set number of meals every day. And if it's not coordinated with the shelter that you're bringing 100 plates of barbecue, the shelter is throwing away 100 of the meals that they had prepared. So it's wasteful. It's a bad stewardship of overall community resources. Public safety is also impacted when people are running across the street to get a coat that somebody wants to drop off. So, Chris, what we've done is we've really tried to encourage community groups who want to serve to partner with agencies who are there 365 days a year. Get involved in things that are already going on. The important thing is that the service is rendered in a good spirit of cheerfulness and stewardship, and we want to make sure that that people have all that they need and that we're not being wasteful and that it's done in a spirit of dignity and respect.
Let's go back to the phones now, and this time we will speak with Tyler in Plano. Hi, Tyler.
Hey, guys. How are you doing?
Great. Thank you.
Good, good. I had a quick question, but I wanted to preface it really quickly. As your guests are surely aware, there's different reasons that somebody might find themselves homeless. Maybe it's a series of unfortunate events. They're struggling with addiction, or maybe it's the only life they've ever known. But for some people, it absolutely there are some people who are homeless because of their own faults. And I was just wondering, I wanted to get their opinion on what's the best way to go about combating homelessness while at the same time preventing it from being taken advantage of by, people who are there because of negligence.
I think the number one response, some folks like to say, the central antidote to homelessness is housing. The availability of quality, affordable, accessible housing is absolutely key to ending homelessness. On this issue of personal culpability for homelessness, you know, I find that people are homeless for a variety of reasons. There's bad luck, there's bad choices, and there's bad circumstances. Oftentimes, it's a combination of the three that kind of spirate out of control. One of the things that we found in the last 10 years of addressing this issue of homelessness is that it's very, very important to understand who it is that we're trying to serve. In Tarrant County, for example, we know that less than 20% of the overall population are long-term, what we call chronically homeless people. The majority, by far and away, are singles. There is a minority that are families with children. About 25% of the homeless are children in Tarrant County. About 40% are households with children, and the balance are single adults. Of the single adults, more than half have a disability of some sort. And I think that's really important to point out because very often one of the myths that Mike might agree with is that very often people say, well, folks are homeless because they're lazy. They're homeless because they won't work or don't work. And in fact, what we find is that homeless people really do want to work to the extent that they are able. If you've got a disability, if you're severely mentally ill, if your brain has been your brain chemistry has been deformed by substance abuse, Say what you want about the consequences, they're out there, and it's expensive to public systems, it's detrimental to neighborhood quality of life, and it's killing that person. So the responses, I think we would have to repeat, are primarily we've got to get folks into housing, and we've got to provide them with a robust array of supportive services so that they can regain their footing and move on with their lives.
Otis, you spoke earlier about the unintended consequences of occasionally of people's very benevolent intentions.
Absolutely.
What would either of you have us do when we drive somewhere and we are approached by someone who looks to be in bad shape, who asks us for money or for food or for shelter of some kind? What do we do?
Yeah, I think it's important that as much as possible, every citizen has a handle on where people who are homeless can get services in the community, and to steer that person that way. And you have to, I think the pat answer is, you know, don't give a person a handout, you know, encourage them to seek help. I think that's a personal choice, and it's based on your, you know, your intuition and your impression of the person, if you can really be helpful. Or if you're being scammed. But I think the most important thing about that interaction is you treat that person with respect, whatever your decision is in terms of helping or not.
I would agree. In the Fort Worth Directions Home Plan, we do encourage citizens to not give money to panhandlers. What we believe is that the majority of funds that are given to people who are asking for money are in fact spent on drugs, alcohol, and prostitution. Instead, I encourage people to, if they really want to give something, maybe carry some gift certificates for fast food or a gift card to Target or Kroger, a place where somebody can get something to eat. I think it's also very important and very helpful to be able to say, hey, as Mike said, I know where you can get some help. I give my money, for example, to the Salvation Army. I make donations to the Union Gospel Mission. Do you know how to get there?
Mm-hmm.
That way you've helped them, you've engaged them in a respectful conversation, you've acknowledged that you want to help, and you've directed them to professional resources that can step in and hopefully identify needs and respond accordingly.
How far away, realistically, are we from eliminating homelessness in North Texas?
Well, Metro Dallas Homeless Alliance, City of Dallas, we're dedicated to ending chronic homelessness by 2014, and I think we're well on the way. You know, I think we're going to get close, but there's if there. And our expectation is that starting 2010, we're into a new era of neighborhoods and communities really investing themselves in making formerly homeless people their neighbors and accepting and even cheerleading housing for those folks, and that we're looking for our state legislature and our elected officials to really invest in services the way that they need. Yeah, we're going to get there.
Mike Fanza is president and CEO of the Metro Dallas Homeless Alliance. Otis Thornton is homelessness coordinator for the city of Fort Worth. Guys, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.